Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Lisa Hawkins, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is Real Women Run, and today's guest is Dee Dee Corradini. Dee Dee Corradini is one of Utah's most prominent businesswomen and politicians. Ms. Corradini is now the Senior Vice President for Prudential Utah Real Estate, and she's also been the President of the Women's Ski Jumping USA for 3 years. She has taken a lead role in the battle to get women's ski jumping into the Olympic Winter Games. In fact, she's just returned from Sochi. Additionally, Ms. Corradini's efforts were central to bringing the 2002 Winter Olympics to Utah. Ms. Corradini attended school in Lebanon and Syria for 11 years as a child. She received a Bachelor of Arts from Drew University and a Master's degree in Psychology from the University of Utah. She served as Press Secretary to Congressman Wayne Owens of Utah and then Representative Richard Ottinger of New York in the early 1970s. From 1992 to 2002, Dee Dee Corradini served as the 32nd mayor of Salt Lake City. She was Salt Lake City's first and only female mayor. Please help me welcome Dee Dee Corradini.
Thank you, and it's great to be here. Actually, I did my last 2 years of my bachelor's degree here at the U, and I used to take classes here in Orson Spencer Hall, and it hasn't changed much since those days many, many years ago. So great to be back, and great to be back at Hinckley Institute, because I've spoken here quite a few times over the years, especially while I was mayor, and it's always a privilege to be here. And I'm so excited because, as you heard, I worked for Wayne Owens. I was his press secretary, and you're all too young to remember Wayne, but the Hinckley Institute remembers Wayne, and I'm thrilled that his son, Doug Owens, is going to run for Congress this year. And just he called me last night and brought back memories of back many, many years ago. I worked for Wayne from 1972, I think in 71, and Tim Chambliss and I go back to those early Wayne Owens days back in 1971 and went to Washington until 1975 working with him. But I thought I'd start, since I just got back from Sochi, to talk just a little bit about the Olympics, and because it's such a huge deal for those of us in Utah, and I'm a big supporter of us hosting the Olympics again in 2026, if the United States Olympic Committee will let us bid. But actually, I got involved in 2004. Here I was the mayor of Salt Lake City when we got the Olympics for 2002, and we worked so hard to get women into skeleton and bobsleigh for the 2002 Olympic Games. Women weren't allowed in either of those sports. And it was quite an effort to get them in, but we did. And nobody ever brought up ski jumping, that women still couldn't ski jump in the Olympics. And everybody assumed that women jumped in the Olympics. The men have been jumping since 1924. It's one of the original Olympic sports. And so in 2004, 2 years after the Olympics, I happened to be at a coffee with this young woman, and I started talking to her at the coffee break, and it turned out to be Lindsay Vann, who's a ski jumper. She wound up being our 2009 world champion, and she's the one who told me women still could not jump in the Olympics. And I was flabbergasted. I just couldn't believe, what do you mean women can't ski jump in the Olympics? So, of course they've been jumping. And it turned from, I wound up meeting some of the rest of our team. They all live in Park City. And I started talking to the members of the women's ski jumping team. And the more I heard their stories, the more I thought, this sounds like discrimination to me. And I got hooked, and got on the board of this fledgling little organization, a 501c3 called Women's Ski Jumping USA, that the parents had put together using a Nonprofits for Dummies book. And it was the parents just trying to help these young women go around the world to compete. And while the guys, the U.S. men's ski jumpers, were staying in hotel rooms, our women were staying, in some occasions, in barns above cows with no, in Europe, with no running water, I mean, no hot water, no heat. And it was a real struggle for these women. And it was an eight-year battle, started in 2004, to get the women into the Olympics that was unbelievable. And if you haven't seen the movie, Ready to Fly, it's a documentary, it's a 1 hour, it's on Xfinity. It's a fascinating story. And our fight to get these women into the Olympics became much more than about women's ski jumping. It became a battle about women's rights and human rights. And we wound up winning for many reasons. We had all kinds of efforts going at the same time. We had to raise money for us to travel the world to try to get go to meetings of the International Ski Federation to try to convince them to let the women into the World Championships, which you have to do before you can get into the Olympics. But we also had to pay to keep our athletes competing around the world. And by the way, our top man, male ski jumper in the United States, is ranked about 47 to 50 worldwide. We had women, three of our athletes, in the top 10 worldwide. And yet that's the way we were getting treated. And it was really pretty bad. So we got voted down in the ski jumping committee at the International Ski Federation. When we went to them to try to get the women into the World Championships, we kept getting told no, 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 all the way along. We finally got to the International Olympic Committee after we got them into 2009 World Championships. They told us no, and that's when we finally decided our goal was Vancouver 2010. Got to get the athletes into that Olympics. And finally, we met a lawyer in Vancouver and said, what can we do? We've got to do something legally because the IOC is not going to let these women in. And this lawyer had an idea, and he said, I think we can't sue the International Olympic Committee because they answer to nobody, but we could sue VANOC, the Vancouver Organizing Committee, on 3 points. Number one, you are discriminating against these women based on the facts. And the facts that we had were that if what we looked at is how many women from how many countries were in other sports when they were admitted to the Olympics. And if you look at luge, bobsleigh, skier cross, skeleton, we had more women and more countries competing at the elite level than any of those sports did when they were admitted, women were admitted to the Olympics. And so we went to court with those facts. You are discriminating against these women based on the facts. Number two, you, VANOC, are a quasi-governmental organization because you're taking governmental money to put on the Vancouver Olympics. Therefore, you're subject to the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which is like our Title IX. And then point number three was, therefore, you cannot host a men's only event. If you're going to do the men, you got to do the women. If you're not going to do the women, can't have a men's event either, which upset the male ski jumpers a little bit because they were threatened, but that was our lawsuit. And we went to the Supreme Court of British Columbia. We wound up winning on the first 2 points, but the judge said, but nobody controls the IOC. Only the IOC can decide what events get into the Olympics. We took it to the Court of Appeals, got the same result. We went to the Supreme Court of Canada, and we were now 2 months before the Olympics in Vancouver 2010, and the Supreme Court turned us down and wouldn't take the case. So we lost in Vancouver 2010. And that's when Lindsey Vann would have been our gold medalist. She was in her prime. She's 29 now, but she was just the right age and at the right point in her career. And so we decided it was a strategy. Okay, bottom line is we had embarrassed the International Olympic Committee so badly because for the first time a court had told the IOC, you are discriminating against these women. They had never been told that before. And it was highly embarrassing. Then we had media coverage that was huge from all over the world. The media realized this was discrimination, and so we were getting editorials, let the women jump, this is discrimination. So I think the IOC finally realized they had to let the women into Sochi 2014, or they were going to get beaten up in the media and embarrassed for a long, long time. So it was amazing to be there in Sochi when the women jumped on the 11th. Our women did not medal. Sarah Hendrickson, I don't know if you follow any of this, it's been in the media quite a bit, but she blew out her knee 5 months ago, and she was our gold medalist, Sarah Hendrickson. And she had surgery, and she worked her heart out and her body out she'd be at the gym for 6 hours a day, every single day, getting her knee back in shape and her body back in shape to make Sochi, which she did. And Lindsey Vann went. She deserved it. Of all the athletes, Lindsey should have been there. Since age 7, she said, I want to be in the Olympics someday. And then we took Jessica Jerome, our top 3 jumpers. We didn't win a medal. Sarah Takanashi of Japan was supposed to be the gold medalist. And the media was looking for a Sarah versus Sarah contest. Sarah Takanashi versus Sarah Hendrickson. And it was interesting because we didn't medal, and Sarah Takanashi had this group of Japanese, the media was all over our athletes as well as Sarah Takanashi. It was funny because there were the Japanese media was in this huddle, and if Sarah Takanashi took one step, the media was right with her because they were just assuming she was going to win a gold medal. And she came in 4th. And it shows how the pressure on our athletes as well as on Sarah Takanashi was so huge because there were expectations. But yet, it was a joyous occasion because as far as we were concerned, we were cheering everybody on. These women became a sorority over the last 10 years of this battle to get to the Olympics. And it was so exciting because we cheered them all on, and as far as we were concerned, every single woman ski jumper won that event. So it was very exciting to be there. We were worried about security before we went. There wasn't any indication that security was a problem the whole time we were there. And it was just very, very exciting. It's a little strange to go to the Olympics and have palm trees down in the coastal cluster where all of the events are. The weather, as you've been seeing on TV, is now in the 60s. It was in the mid-50s. But I just wanted to share that because it's a Utah story, but it's really a bigger story than that. It's gone worldwide. Yes?
Can I ask a question? The women don't do anything. Where's the mic? Sorry. The women don't do
Tama.
They don't do Big Hill. Can you explain why?
Yes. The international, the women were only allowed to jump on the normal hill. And the men have 3 events, the normal hill, the large hill, and the team event. And the FIS, the International Ski Federation that controls our sport, was not going to let the women jump on anything other than the normal hill. And part of what we were facing when we started this in 2004 was the old European male attitudes. And the head of the FIS was quoted, as you may have seen, saying, ski jumping is inappropriate for ladies from a medical point of view, as though our uteruses were going to fall out. Even the week before the jump, the Russian male men's ski jumping coach said that women should not be ski jumping their bodies. It's not good for their bodies because if men get hurt, they can recover. But if women get hurt, it would be much worse for women. Mm-hmm. And besides, women should be at home raising children, cooking, and cleaning house. That was a quote just a week before the women jumped. So we're still fighting that kind of an attitude, and our goal now is we're already, I was on the phone on my way down here for an hour, strategizing how we're going to get the women in 2018 on the large hill and in the team event. And I was very upset because in Sochi, the race director who controls Nordic combined and ski jumping was quoted by the AP as hinting that women would not be allowed on the large hill for another 8 years. And that really, really upset us. So we've got our work cut out for us. So we're not there yet. And again, this is a much bigger story because it's about equality. It's about women's rights. It's about human rights. And women have just had to fight so hard for these sports and their other sports in Summer and Winter Olympics where the equality is just way, way below what the men have. So that's my Olympic story, and I'm still kind of living back in Sochi, and it's hard to believe. I watched the news at night from Sochi, and it's hard to believe I was there, and now I'm watching it here on TV. But I'm supposed to talk about politics, but this was politics, and that's why I wanted to share it, because this was one of the most toughest political campaigns I'd ever been through. 8 years to fight this battle. And there's a lot you haven't even heard, but do, if you get a chance, go to Xfinity and watch Ready to Fly. It's won several documentary awards, and it's our story of those 8 years.
Yes. You were asking, well, you were saying that you had some strategies of how you're going to get the women into those events. Will you please elaborate on that?
Well, the strategy was nobody knew women couldn't jump. 99.9% of the people you talked to back in 2004, and even today, people don't realize that women can't jump, but more and more people now know that. So one prong was we had to educate people that women couldn't jump. And when I was mayor, one of the media guys that covered me, we knew we needed media. We needed national media. We needed international media to spread the word, was Howard Berkus of NPR. He used to cover me during my mayoral years. So I called Howard up and I said, Howard, I think I've got a story for you. And talked Howard into doing a story on NPR. And he is the one that on NPR got John Franco Casper, the head of the FIS, to say it's inappropriate for ladies from a medical point of view, which we used over and over and over again. The media had a ball with that quote. And then we got ABC News interested. I live in Park City, and one of our folks was at a cocktail party in Park City and ran into John Quinones of ABC News, bent his ear. He wound up doing a national ABC News story. So we started to get the media on our side, which we had to do. We were doing everything we could to try to convince the FIS and the IOC to let us in, but they just refused. So we figured media is the way to go. We'd raised enough money that we were spending money. So, for example, in Vancouver, when the IOC was having a meeting in Vancouver, they were coming to check out Vancouver before the Games, we put up a huge billboard right outside the where the IOC was going to meet that said, "Let the women jump," and it was a picture of Lindsey Vonn jumping, which irritated the heck out of them. But we did whatever we could to get attention. And it made the news there. And then I think the thing that broke the camel's back was our lawsuit. It was huge to have this lawsuit. And we had international media on our side by that point. So it was a combination of all that. But it was one of the toughest political campaigns that I have ever run. So now I'll talk about my other campaign, because I was asked to talk about being mayor of Salt Lake. I grew up in Lebanon and Syria, and I've always been fascinated with international, not politics, but what goes on in the world. And when I grew up, I came back to the States when I was 14 and moved to Maine. So I lived all up and down the East Coast, and I moved to Maine. And at the time, my United States senator was the only woman in the United States Senate, and her name was Margaret Chase Smith. And I didn't know women could be senators, United States senators. So I was in high school, and I wrote her a letter, and just of admiration, and she wrote me back. Those were the days when politicians actually read their letters and wrote you back and actually signed their letters. And she basically said to me, you can do it, go for it. You know, you can do whatever you want to do. And it got something in my mind, because I'd grown up in the Middle East, and I thought, okay, my goal is I'd like to become a United States senator, get on the Foreign Affairs Committee, and then help the Middle East, because peace in the Middle East has been something that I've wanted for my entire life. And so I went to college at Drew University in New Jersey, majored in political science, thought I'd major in political science, but I couldn't get above a C in my intro to poli-sci. I just, you know, and I was getting A's in psychology. So I thought, well, something's wrong, trying to tell me something here. So I switched to psych for my major, minored in sociology. Those were the days I met my ex-husband when I was a freshman. I was pinned my junior year. I was engaged my senior year. We got married the day after graduation. By the way, I transferred to the U my junior year, so I finished up here and then did my master's here. And got off track because wound up having two kids when I was quite young. And so anyway, I got off my track and I decided I've got to get back to politics somehow. And went to work for former Governor Cal Rampton. So I figured, okay, that's a good step. And did some of his major speeches and worked for him in one of his departments. Then I heard about this young guy, Wayne Owens, who was running for Congress. So I flew back to Washington, and I said, I want to work on your campaign. And I wound up in the early days of his campaign, along with Tim, and I wound up being his press secretary in the campaign. And if you haven't read up on his campaign, he walked the state. And it was amazing. And that's how we got free press. And you got to get a lot of free press if you don't have a lot of money. And it was one of the most amazing campaigns that I've ever been a part of. And I've been a part of quite a few over the years. And wound up going to Washington with Wayne as his press secretary. And that was, my 3 years in Washington were just absolutely amazing. I learned more in Washington in 3 years than I could have learned anywhere else in the world in 10, I think, working on the Hill. But I was by now a single mom with these two little kids. And I came back to Utah because I figured I needed to spend more time with my kids, because if you work on the Hill, you're a workaholic. And worked at Snowbird, started a government relations consulting firm, and after 15 years doing that, I was bored stiff of doing the same thing. And the mayor said he wasn't running for office, and it never occurred to me to run for local office. And I knew I couldn't win a congressional seat because I'm a Democrat. And in Utah, it's pretty tough to win a statewide election, although I still have hopes, or a congressional seat. We'll see what Doug can do. Maybe he can take over Jim Matheson's seat. So, and I know some of you are Republicans, I'm sure, so don't take offense. It's just where I come from. But anyway, the mayor said he wasn't going to run, and I'd been so involved in Salt Lake City. I'd been on every board imaginable and been on the ballet board, and I chaired the symphony board, and I was on the chamber board and so on. So I knew a lot of the key players in Salt Lake. And Salt Lake was having some real problems back then. This was 1991, and gangs... our gang problem was going up at 100% a year. People had fled Salt Lake City for the suburbs, and crime was up, and we didn't have enough housing in the city for people who wanted to live in the city. But who's going to live in a city if your crime is going up 100% a year and your gangs? We had drive-by shootings on the west side of town were just almost daily. I may be exaggerating, but it was regular. So those were the issues, and I thought, I know this city pretty well, maybe I can help. So I ran against four guys and won. Never run for anything before. Had no idea what the departments of city government were. I had to memorize them, and then I kept getting a couple of them confused. But I did have an interesting helper, and that is that David Axelrod was he ran both of my campaigns. And he wasn't well known then. He certainly is now, having run both of Obama's campaigns, but amazing guy. And being mayor, in my opinion, because I've served in state government, I've served in the federal government, and I've served in local government, my personal opinion is local government is the best. I think being mayor of Salt Lake was the best thing in my entire life that I've ever done. You can really make things happen. I think it's one of the toughest jobs because at least in Washington, yeah, you've got your constituents coming to see you all the time, but you're not here. I mean, I couldn't go to the grocery store and buy, you know, if I was in a rush to buy milk and just wanted to rush back out, you can't do it. You have to take, people want to talk to you, and if you don't want to talk, then they think, especially if you're a woman, I think you're treated differently. I certainly was. You know, you're cold if you're not super friendly all the time, whereas if I had been a man, I think I was treated differently. The media treated me differently. There were two guys in the media who, I'd only been in office for a few weeks, and they were already trying to bash me. It was almost like, oh, let's see if she's tough enough to handle this. But it was an amazing, amazing experience, and I strongly recommend that you think about local office if any of you were thinking about running for office, and which brings me to Real Women Run. I'm also, if you look at women in any career, whether it's sports, government, business, across the board, women are still, we're not making progress, we're going backwards in Utah. We're still at 16-17% in leadership roles. And we're not making progress. In politics, we're going backwards in this state. And so that's why a whole group of us got together to form Real Women Run 2.5 years ago to get women to think about running for office. And what we realized, the data shows that men think differently about running for office. Men, and you'll have to excuse me, but I'm just using the same language I use anywhere else, but men will wake up, look at themselves in the mirror in the morning and say, I think I'll run for president. Women don't do that. Women have to be asked, convinced, and so on. And the data is all there that shows this. And so we decided at Real Women Run to get the word out and to ask women, come consider it, think about it, because I truly believe that women have something to contribute, and if we were at 50% of in leadership positions in government and in any other sphere, I mean, you look at business, the data shows that if major corporations have at least three women on their board, it has to be three, that the business, the bottom line, is much better than it is without those women on the board. The data is there to show that. And I truly believe that if 50% of government were women, that we would have a better world. I don't think we'd have had a government shutdown. That's my opinion. But I really think we have to work on this and get women to the point where we're side by side with men, not putting men down, but side by side with men, because I think together we can all make better decisions. So my commitment going forward is about getting young women and young girls to think about leadership in whatever field. I'm also the immediate past president of the International Women's Forum. And we're in 30 countries. It's by invitation. You have to be a woman leader in your field to be invited to join. And I've been working hard to bring in other countries, so we just voted in Lebanon, Turkey, and Egypt. And I'm just leaving for Beirut again. I'm on the board of a school in Beirut. I'm leaving next week, and I'll be going to Beirut again and Istanbul to meet with our new chapter there, and then I'm going to Dubai. We're starting a chapter in the UAE. And our whole purpose is women's leadership. We have fellows programs. We have an on-the-board program to get women onto corporate boards. And again, it's to get women into leadership positions, because I think that's what we need. So that's a little bit about what I've been up to, and I'm going to throw it open for questions on anything.
My name's Julie Clark. I'm a senior at the U, and I'm also an intern at the Utah legislature right now.
At the what?
The state legislature.
Oh,
at the
great.
Capitol. And one question that I have been thinking about as far as women in politics, what would you say in response to people who would claim that women are too emotional or they make decisions not based on, you know, like logic, but on emotions? I have seen that just a little bit. I'll be in a meeting and I'll wonder, you know, they'll seem a little bit more emotional. I don't know whether that's based on, you know, that's really where their decisions come from. But I do see it that they do. Sometimes there are women that do seem a little bit more emotional in their decision making. And I just wanted to know kind of your thoughts on that.
So I don't know if you all heard that, but on women being more emotional. I don't know how many of you saw Bode Miller crying on TV and on his knees crying after he finished his event the other day and took bronze. So I think men are getting more emotional, and I think it's a good thing. I mean, because I think men have been brought up, and I'm a parent of a boy and a girl. They're now grown. But I think we have traditionally raised our boys to not be emotional, and it's okay if girls are. But my attitude has always been, in everything I've done my entire life, career-wise, is just the main thing is performance. Do a good job. Show other people that you're doing a good job, that you're making things happen, and just be yourself. I tend to look at people not as in a meeting as someone's a man or someone's a woman, but we're all people, and we're just all trying to accomplish some kind of a goal. And it's worked for me. So I think we all have to learn, men and women, that we do come with a different perspective, but that's good, because together we make a better team. So I don't know how else to respond to that. I'm sorry. In the back?
Hi, my name is Shanna Meekum. I'm currently a senior political science degree. My question for you is, there are many factors and barriers that keep women from running for office. But in your opinion, what is the leading factor or barrier that keep them from doing so?
The main thing that keeps women from running for office is, A, they don't think about it, and B, you hear the same things. I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to raise money. Raising money is always a huge issue. And the other thing is, how do I balance, you know, family and whatever else I'm doing and run for office too? How do I do that? And my nature is, where there's a will, there's a way. I mean, if you want to do it, there's a way to figure it out. I mean, I was a single mom for 10 years with two little kids, and I've worked my entire life, and I'd have been a lousy mother if I'd been a full-time mother, for starters. It worked, and I figured out how to find phenomenal childcare for my kids, and weekends were always for them. But in terms of preparing other women to run for office, that's what Real Women Run is doing, and it's working. We have a full-day training session every year. We do it. We just had one in January. Our first year, we couldn't believe it. We were hoping to have maybe, you know, 20 women show up. We had 300 women who showed up for training our first year. Couldn't believe it. And we have classes. We have people who've done it before teaching. You know, here's how you raise money. Here's how you put together a campaign. Hinckley Institute, by the way, is one of our partners in Real Women Run and has been terrific. And Lindsay Zazumbo has said, you know, if you need a campaign manager, we'll find you one. So we are training in all of that. We bring in media folks. We always have a print media and a TV media and a radio media person there who actually teach classes. Here's how to deal with us. So, and then anyone who wants to run in the next cycle, we have a more in-depth training for those women in March. And so that's coming up. And then we'll do it again next year. And we're always planning for whatever cycle is coming up. And it's working. We had 100 women that came in January for our training. And so we've got Mia Love has been, she's running again. And so is Donna McAleer. Both are Real Women Run women. And in this last cycle, four of the six women who've been through our training won their elections. They were in smaller cities in Utah because we're statewide, but they won. And so we think that's what is needed to get more women to run. So come to our training.
Hello. Firstly, thank you for taking the time to come speak to us today. It's a great pleasure. My name's Erica. I'm a senior here at the U. I have two quick questions for you, hopefully. One, you mentioned either as a medical professional or newscaster having the opinion or his opinion that women should stay home and take care of the children and be, you know, stay-at-home mothers. I come from a rural family where my parents kind of flip-flop that role, so I have a stay-at-home dad. My mom works full-time. How would you address that stereotype here in Utah specifically where a lot of women, if they do pursue higher education, feel like it's either a hobby until they find a husband where they can stop then and not see it as a long-term pursuit or a career? And then secondly, play devil's advocate a bit, do you feel that because we have less women in politics and business that the diversity issues are changing so firms will hire a woman more so even if she's not fully, you know, capable or prepared over a man just to have that diversity in the firm?
Well, so the first question was...
How would you break the stereotype?
Oh, the stereotype. Well, if all you have to do is look at the divorce rates in Utah, they're pretty high for Utah and our family values here. So I'm a big believer that women need to assume that you need to get your education and have a career because you never know what's going to happen. And... you know, whatever your family values are, culturally, whatever, I think women have got to be prepared. Because you never know. Your husband could die, and you'd be a single mom with a bunch of little kids. I mean, anything can happen. And so I think that's one thing that we need to educate women in Utah about. And we're not getting enough women in Utah to graduate from college. It's a problem. And so we have a lot of work to do there. And then the second question.
Do you think firms or businesses, because
I don't think we've gotten to that point, no, where they'd hire a less qualified woman just to have a woman. But one of the things that I would like to work on is to try to get companies more aware of how important women are in the workforce. And one of the things, and I'm just throwing this out, it hasn't happened at all, but I want to talk to our, we have a chapter of the International Women's Forum here, and one of the things I'm thinking about that other chapters have done is they actually have an award ceremony every year for the corporations that have the most women in their leadership teams or on their boards, and that maybe that's a way to get our companies here in Utah to think more about that. Is let's have an award ceremony. And I mean, Zions Bank would come out way, way high. Their promotion of women is amazing. And they won all kinds of National Bankers Association awards for their women. And they really, really emphasize hiring women. So we need more companies to think the way Zions Bank does. I admire them greatly for that.
My name is Brian Smith. I'm
senior political science here at the U. Thanks again for coming. I wish we had an entire forum on the Olympics. That would be incredible. I have a wife of 4 years and a new baby of like 3 months, and with the prevalent traditional family values that we have here in Utah, I was growing up kind of assuming that I would be responsible for providing and being the provider for the family. Without breaking really that understanding that I can still be a provider, what can I do to help? My wife, she owns her own business. She has a little interior design business. And what can I do to help empower her to be a leader, to run for things, and to get involved as a husband, but also as, you know, someone who plans on not being a stay-at-home dad? What can I do to help her?
I think some of the most exciting relationships are those where both husband and wife have exciting careers, because it brings a dynamic to the relationship. By the way, my major was psychology, and I have a master's in psych. But I really think that makes for a very special relationship, and my husband and I both have our careers, and we get home, and it's exciting to get together and talk about what we each did that day in our careers. And yet, I have kids, I have grandchildren now, and that's very much a part of our family mix, and very exciting one. And so I think part of it is getting her to meet other women who are doing things, because I think we all need mentors and role models and champions. And there's a difference between a mentor and a champion. A mentor is someone you look up to who's willing to spend time with you and you know, figure out who her mentors might be, and go meet them. I mean, I've done a lot of mentoring in my life. I've had women say, can I come talk to you? And I'll spend time with them, and hopefully it influences them to go do something more than they had been doing. A champion is someone, and we're talking more about that these days in terms of women's leadership, is someone, say you're in a corporate setting and you want to advance in that corporation. You need to find someone in that corporation, male or female, who will literally champion you with others in the company to see that you keep getting better and better and move up. So looking for those kinds of things. You do your influencing, but if she could meet other women that are doing really exciting things, that might give her something exciting to think about.
I have one. My name is Kendall. I am a senior here at the U. Thank you for coming.
Are you
again.
All seniors?
No.
How many are seniors? Okay.
So one of the things that we've been working on, I also work at the Hinckley, and one of the things we've been working on is trying to bring real women run to the U. That's obviously a big part of why we have you today. And I'm wondering, what do you think is the biggest thing that students can do to kind of start that path of being civically engaged, of running for office, of supporting those women who want to run for office if they don't themselves? What do you think we can do as students to sort of promote this effort in Utah and that kind of thing?
Well, first thing I recommend to everybody is work on a campaign. And you have to get in early if you really want to have a critical role in the campaign. If you come in later, you're one of, you know, hundreds that have volunteered to help. But find someone who's going to run and get in really early so you're on the ground floor of a campaign. It is win or lose. It's better to win, but... It is so exciting to do that. Two, boy, if you have a chance to go to Washington and do a Hinckley internship, do it. It is an amazing, amazing experience. My son was a Senate page for Jake Garn many years ago, and it was an experience of a lifetime for him. And I think it's only 3 months or something like that, but what an experience. And three, I tell all women, think about running yourself. And to me, running for office is public service. It's not a career. I think we have too many career politicians in this country, and that's part of our problem. I like Scott Matheson's approach toward when he was governor. It was get in, give it your all, and get out. And that's my philosophy. Think about running for office at some point in your life as public service. Do whatever you want to do. Figure out when that time is, but do it, because we need everybody to be involved in our public discourse and in our government at some point in time. And there's so many things you can do. We're also teaching women in Real Women Run about serving on boards. When I was mayor, my gosh, the number of boards that Salt Lake City has, the tendency is to pick the same people over and over again for these major, major boards that are making major decisions about our future in Salt Lake City. The same is true at the county, at the state. There are a gazillion boards. And to serve on any of those boards, and they're all on the web, go find a board you'd like to serve on that you think you have some qualifications for, and do that. So the sky's the limit in terms of what you can do.
Hi, my name's Joshua Castro. So what about women who are also a minority ethnically? Has there been an increasing trend in Utah in for them in leadership positions?
We desperately need our minority women and men involved just as much as everybody else. And having grown up in foreign countries, I think the mix of different cultures makes life so much more rich and exciting to have foreign perspectives, different perspectives. And this is a little funny, but when I was mayor, just to give an example of, we had so many different folks living here from all different countries, but one of the most interesting things that happened was I'd get these phone calls and my administrative assistant would say, you know, we've got this problem from this constituent, and I did have someone who handled it, but one of the issues that came up that was funny but serious at the same time is one of the women called in and she said, I'm sorry, but I've got a problem. We've got a neighbor who is grilling a pony on a spit in the backyard, and it's right near my backyard. Well, it turns out that it was from a culture where grilling ponies is part of the culture, and yet some little girl had sold her pony, and it wound up on a spit. But just to show you that there are so many different cultures that are already living here, and so I hired two people who handled my minority affairs who understood those other cultures and could help bring them in, because sometimes foreign cultures move here and they feel isolated. And we need to bring them in and include them in everything that happens, including running for office. And we've got several minorities in the legislature. And so I totally agree with you. And if you know anybody that would be interested in Real Women Run, we're on the website. Contact us, and we'd love to get them involved in our training.
My name is Derek Deitch. I am also a senior here. My question is, so I think there are a lot of prominent world leaders, such as the Chancellor of Germany. I think you look at Costa Rica, Argentina, Liberia, that have women leaders. Do you think that there's something in the culture of the United States that is holding that back? And if so, what can we kind of do to enact kind of wide-scale change to enable more women leaders?
I couldn't agree with you more. It's embarrassing that there are so many countries who've had women leaders and we haven't had one yet. I think Hillary has the best shot of becoming our first, and who knows how that will work out. But it often does take an example. Some foreign countries, though, have, what do you call it, where a certain percentage has to be women in their legislatures. So that has helped in some countries. People have asked me, would that ever work here? I don't think it would ever happen here. But you need examples. And so I was the first woman mayor of Salt Lake City, and I used to go spend a lot of time in the schools, especially I love to go to the elementary schools. And I spent a lot of time in West Salt Lake City because I felt that's where the kids needed attention. And it was interesting over the 8 years that I was mayor, the number of young girls, because I always would say to the kids, okay, how many of you are going to run for mayor of Salt Lake City someday? And when I first asked that question, when I was a brand new mayor, none of the girls raised their hands. By the time I left, there were girls raising their hands like crazy. So women and girls need to see people in those positions. And we've got to elect them. And so I challenge women that if you are not running for office yourself, find a woman who is and help get them elected. We need more women, visible women in positions of power.
One more question. Thank you for speaking to us. To conclude, do you see optimism, given the demographics, more women and men in the population, in the workplace, on college and university campuses, projecting to the future, given what you've been involved with, reasons for optimism that the time is going to come that we're going to have women in the highest levels of leadership in the national legislature, the Congress, where it's 17% House, 20% Senate, and the legislature?
I'm an optimist, and I think we're going to get there. It's going to take longer than I would like it to take, but I think it's all of us. I think you men need to encourage women, and you women need to encourage each other, because if we all work together, we can have a much better world going forward much sooner than it's going to happen if we don't all get together and work on it. And thanks so much for being here today, and appreciate it.